Oh, good evening, everyone. Hopefully, it's not had a bunch of dead air there. It hung on the go live thing for a little bit. But yes, we are back with our normal Thursday stream. I know there's a couple of people asked me, well, who seemed excited about this, asked me a couple of questions about it. But we will be going over AI today, as the title suggests. And we are joined by our guest, Praiser Folly. Have I disconnected here?
Oh, I'm not
You're
sure.
back. Oh, was I gone for a second there? That's a bit annoying.
Possibly.
It didn't. Oh, Discord didn't show a hiccup there. I was just saying that I was trying to introduce you and Praiser Folly if it's disappeared.
Are we still cutting out? I don't know. I'll keep talking anyway, just to cover the dead air from Discord. But yes, we have Praiser Folly with us today. Talk about the subject of Trump mentioned AI and some related things to go along with it. And not just purely discussing the nature of the thing itself. I mean, I sent out a link both in Telegram and from the stream last week, for, not last week, Monday, about an interview with a guy called Blake Lemoine, who seems to be one of these engineers who's working on Lambda, the software from Google. I work
Yes.
at oh, everyone is still there. Cool. I'm not just talking to
He is
myself, that's good.
Blake Lemoine. He is technical lead for metrics and analysis at the Google search feed. Before I get too far into it, do you want to quickly introduce yourself, Praiser Folly?
Thank you for having me on. I'm Praiser Folly from the Praiser Folly podcast, where I cover current events and my roundtables. I have interviews, debates, discussions, history, philosophy, economics, current events, and politics. Sort of a general smorgasbord of social science issues.
Yeah, I now get to do one of my favorite parts when we ever get any guest on is play the inside baseball, which if I remember correctly, I think I first saw you on an Andy Worski stream with AA about like 5 years ago.
Oh
Yes,
God. That was rough.
Oh, not Andy Worski. Those were in the before times, in the dark
But
times, the long, long ago.
yeah, I see, but no, I think we've sort of bumped into each other more recently on Telegram, and you seem quite keen to talk about this, and I think we're somewhat in similar mind about some elements of it, so it should be a good blether at least. I don't know. Should we dive right into the sources, or anyone else want to bring in first?
We should kind of do a brief introduction about. I think a lot of people will get slightly autistic about like what is and isn't AI and what we define as AI. What we are talking about here and what the video source will talk about as well from a channel called Event Horizon that was linked a couple of times, like you said previously, is the idea of artificial sentience. Is the idea not just of, the intelligent machine, as it were, the bigger calculator, but of actual sentient machines.
Well, it's,
That is
I think
the
it's very
subject here.
telling that they never go on to call it artificial intuition because that, very, it's almost on its own as a set of words together, just doesn't make sense. So it's, I think with the emphasis would be on taking away throughout all the different examples we use, the structure of the human mind, whether you are explicitly religious or not, you must recognize as greater than the sum of its parts. There is things to it that we don't understand, and there's things to it that we might never understand because maybe that's the very point of the thing in the first place. But there is more to it than just silicon chips and being able to recall massive amounts of data, and that not only just in the weird bug man way that we'll get into and maybe have a joke about, but there is also ways in which you can see this similar kind of thinking in different sorts of empirical schools of thought, whether they be about data analytics or how you do data modeling or modeling prediction. A lot of them ultimately boil down to the idea that you can reduce humans to, that we've talked before about the idea of Homo economicus from Mises, another economist. This idea you can reduce it down to single tangible figures and think about it as a sort of bag full of chemicals and electronic signals, and that's just it. There's nothing more to it than that.
Now we get on to, like you said, we're going to frame the first part of this, though, because we're going to read a little bit from Human Action again, because you're right about the economic side of this. It's AI has been framed in a very similar way to the way that economic managers are and economic modeling is, and the way that economic modeling is done and the information, you know, the knowledge problem, the calculation problem and things like that. It's posited often as a solution to it in many ways. Do you want to go ahead and just read the first paragraph there? It's relevant because he's talking, I think, about the prime mover. It's very
some of the sections we've got here are from the sort of first 100 or so pages of Human Action, which people pick up and go, why is there loads of philosophy in my economics book? But I think having read through it for the fundraiser thing and gone through some of that sections with people listening, I think there was a few people I saw in chat being like, wait, this all makes sense now. So hopefully they've bitten the bug and gone and read the rest of it, but carry on. Since time immemorial, men have been eager to know the prime mover, the cause of all being and of all change, the ultimate substance from which everything stems and which is the cause of itself. Science is more modest. It is aware of the limits of the human mind and of the human search for knowledge. It aims at tracing back every phenomenon to its cause, but it realises that these endeavours must necessarily strike against insurmountable walls. There are phenomena which cannot be analysed and traced back to other phenomena. They are the ultimate given. Progress of scientific research may succeed in demonstrating that something previously considered as an ultimate given can be reduced to components, but there will always be some irreducible and unanalysable phenomena, some ultimate given. I suppose we can... There is more to that source we can get into, but I think the main meat of bones of it is just that it's a simple notion, but the idea that in any human sort of action, I suppose is the word, there is some driver to it. There is some driver to making you act, be what it is, whether it's a response to something or it's you coming up with an original thought. But there is something there that maybe you could call consciousness, whatever term you want to give it, but it cannot be reduced. You can't get more out of it than what's there, shall we say, in from qualitative to quantitative.
It's a very classical view. It's a very kind of Aristotelian, kind of Thomas Aquinas view of things as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess it's a philosophical objection that can be raised just on the face of it to AI. Now, what do you think about that praise of folly? Do you think AI is even possible? That's the first question.
Right. Well, I don't. And I think what is one thing to helpful to point out here is, on the one hand, from pop culture and science popularizers, we have an idea of AI, which is sort of like HAL from 2001, A Space Odyssey, this sentient computer that acts in its own self-interest to preserve its own existence, that can have a conversation with humans, and for all, you know, all intellectual and mental categories is indistinguishable from a human, but it's a machine. Or also the idea of androids, like an iRobot. And so there's this idea that you can have, for all relevant matters of mind and brain, some sort of machine replica. Now, that was, where I was growing up, that was just called AI. But there's a distinction that's made between strong AI and weak AI. Strong AI would be like HAL, which is a computer that can learn and think and have qualia and have human-like experiences. And then you have weak AI, which is more of an advanced processing calculating machine, which would be like Deep Blue. And part of the problem here is we've made a lot of gains in what we call weak AI, but because of certain assumptions, which we'll get to in a moment, modern day scientists and engineers believe that we are getting closer to strong AI, or what's also called artificial general intelligence, which is basically intelligence indistinguishable from a human. And the reason why they make that is they assume that the mind and the brain are identical, and i.e. physical. So the mind itself is identical to the brain. Or to put it very succinctly or very technically, for every given mental state, there is a corresponding brain state, such that if we could find, if we knew how to like translate that signal between the two, we could identify any given mental state by looking at brain states. And so the argument is, well, and then also that the mind is a process that develops out of a sufficiently complicated material substructure. well, we could make it out of silicon rather than carbon, and then it would work. But this right here is the key false assumption that the AI theorists make, the idea that the mind and the brain are identical, and more to the point that the mind is a material object.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you're on to what's the next two short little paragraphs here. I might quickly go on before we develop that further. Materialist monism contends that human thoughts and volitions are the product of the operation of bodily organs, the cells of the brain, and the nerves. Human thought, will, and action are solely brought about by material processes which will one day be completely explained by the methods of physical and chemical inquiry. This too is a metaphysical hypothesis, although its supporters consider it as an unshakable and undeniable scientific truth. Various doctrines have been advanced to explain the relation between mind and body. They are mere surmises without any reference to observed facts. All that can be said with certainty is that there are relations between mental and physiological processes. With regard to the nature and the operation of this connection, we know little, if anything. And I think this is a fundamental thing as well when it comes to economics, and why I find so many people who would be quote-unquote nominally right-wing talk about man and man's involvement in economics in such a very left-wing and materialist sense. I mean, as soon as you come to the realization of things like value and its nature is subjective. It is ordinal, not cardinal. You know, you can't say you enjoy some things three times more than you enjoy another thing, but you can say you enjoy it more than the other. But to put an amount on it is not feasible. It's just made up. It means nothing. But as you say, to try and translate the communication in the brain from one chocolate bar to the other being three times better than the other, that's how you end up engaging in these processes of sort of believing you can decode the entirety of the human body and understand it, and by that understand man and his whole. But I don't think that's the case.
I
was going to say, so for example, if we were to look at the brain states eating the first chocolate bar, where the marginal utility value of the chocolate bar is at its greatest, the mental sensation would be different by the time you get to the third chocolate bar, but it's not entirely clear that the brain state is any different. Mm. The same pleasure sensors are probably being triggered, but by the third time it's triggered, the result leads to a different mental state.
Well, it's not even just that. You've got to consider as well that how do you know that you would, if you were trying to scale it across marginal consumption, or you're comparing two different items, the person has the same preference for those items, or that same marginal curve between two different slots of time.
The big problem with AI is that it requires a certain view of humanity. It requires that, for want of a better term, empiricoid view of humanity, that man is reducible down instead to its constituent parts, that there is nothing unique or transcendent about a human being. But a human being, as we'll get to when we talk about the people who advocate for AI and the logical implications of the advocation for AI, that they, through advocating for it, must believe that a man is nothing more than, you know, a clump of cells, to put it that way. To believe in AI, I think, requires you to believe in a lot of the arguments, as we've talked about previously, for things like abortion. It seems a little unrelated to package those things together, but the ways of thinking about people are almost identical in that they are biological machines. It's reverse engineering. And if you believe that a human being is a biological machine, then you fundamentally don't understand what a human being is. And you wouldn't be making an artificial intelligence, you wouldn't make an artificial life form. You'd be making your facsimile of your mental vision of a human biological machine, which a lot of the people who advocate for it don't seem to understand.
Right. So, for example, Noam Chomsky and Lawrence Krauss were discussing the possibility of AI. And Chomsky's like, yeah, humans are just complicated computers. And so he argued that, you know, on that assumption, which is the assumption that I'm going to reject, that we could build artificial intelligence. Now, in theory. But so there's two problems, right? One is, even if we accept that humans are complicated machines, it's not entirely clear that whatever processes produce them, whether it's, you know, panspermia or undirected evolution or whatever you want to use, that humans would be able to replicate that due to limits of knowledge and energy and power. So like the Kardashev scale with like how much energy you can extract, you know, like level one is a whole planet, level two is a whole star, level three is a whole solar system. I mean, what if you had to be level three on the Kardashev scale to make a thinking machine? Now we're so far from that, it's not even feasible to talk about. Or we could talk about why it's false or fallacious to believe that the mind and the brain are identical. And there's basically the most direct way to talk about this is Leibniz, the German mathematician and philosopher, comes up with the law of identity. Well, he modifies the law of identity. So in logic, we have three central axioms: the law of identity, the law of the excluded middle, and the law of non-contradiction. Using the law of identity, Leibniz sort of reflecting on it creates this broader, more explicitly defined rule. So for A to be identical to B, A and B must have all the same properties P at the time, same time T. For example, Joe Biden is identical to the President of the United States if and only if Joe Biden and the President of the United States have the same properties P at time T, which they currently do. So then the question is, okay, well, to demonstrate identity between mind and brain, you have to meet that standard. And there's three sort of reflections on that you can think about that will prove they're not identical. The first one, I call them the three I's, which is indivisibility, indubitability, and incorrigibility. So with the principle of indivisibility, Descartes talks about, well, if for any physical object, you could divide it. So you could talk about the weight, the mass, the extension, the color, the divided unit of some material object, say your brain. But if I were to say, you know, what is the weight of your memory of yesterday's lunch? Or what is the color of your sensation of fear? That's a meaningless nonsense statement.
It's
So
yeah. It's again. It's
brain,
funnily
so the
enough
brain,
to come
go
full
ahead.
circle back to Mises. It's a point about proper abstraction and understanding the limitations of abstraction for the use of scientific investigation. You know, it's we always joke about the fact that there is all these sphere-shaped horses in physics.
Yeah, it's the they're making an estimation of a human being, like a physicist would make an estimation of like a fluid dynamics equation, and that you simplify the shape to make the calculations simpler. That's exactly what happens with AI, and that you end up with these absurdities. You're right, like the color of thought, you know, the sound of fear, things like that.
Because
It, it's purely subjective.
you get the same sort of thing as well as the this is something again we've mentioned, but I think it's always very important to understand the difference between Hayek's understanding of the calculation problem and Mises's sort of understand or what he called, sorry, the knowledge problem, and then Mises's understanding of the calculation problem. The knowledge problem, as you said, was, you know, irrespective of what, or, you know, he assumed that you could calculate the economy by taking all the knowledge in, but he thought, well, we can't deal with all this knowledge, we can't compile all this data into anything useful. In the same way that you're saying, you know, we might not even have the energy to properly run a thinking machine, so there's no point to engage in it. And then the further point of the calculation problem is that even if you could take in all that data, the methods of abstraction are not appropriate to the results you're looking for, so you can't engage in economic calculation in the way that, you know, thousands of different human actors all engaging, because ultimately this is the next source I want to get into, is they all deal with different levels of uncertainty. They all deal with different situations, and that's why they all come up with different solutions to the problem of being a viable actor in a market. And in the same sense, humans solve sort of all problems in differing ways through their own sort of value structure.
You're right. You are right when you hit the nail on the head when you talk about the fact that you have to give attributes to things that are not objective. That you have to make objective, rational machine decisions about things that are, in a sense, esoteric, that they cannot be measured and they cannot be quantified and they certainly cannot be recorded and have an objective quality to them. Yeah, the weight of memory is it's a nice turn of phrase, but it's an absurdity. It's a way we help ourselves to understand things that really are beyond our understanding. And because we are human beings with human limits, they will always be beyond our understanding. And that's again a big divide of mindset there. Are you were getting
Well,
on to?
the weight of memory is good poetry, but bad philosophy.
Yeah. Even worse, science.
Yes.
Even worse, science. But the other I is indubitability, which means that which cannot be doubted. So many philosopher students are familiar with Descartes' cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, and he came to the conclusion that the only thing that could not be doubted was his mind, because even if he was being deceived, there still had to be a mind to be deceived. Now, we can look at Alvin Plantinga brings up a thought experiment based on Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, the man who wakes up in a beetle body. He still has all the memories and thoughts that he had before, but his entire body's been replaced by a beetle body. Now, that which can be doubted is not identical to that which can be doubted, because again, there's a property P, the property that can be doubted. That is the case of one, but not of the other. So from the human point of view, you can't doubt your own self, your own mind, otherwise you wouldn't exist, but you can doubt your own body.
Well, yeah, I was going to say we humans are actually the ship of Theseus.
Right, yeah. And then the last I is incorrigibility, which in the philosophical context means that which is private. So a brain state is a public knowledge truth that can be detected by any properly trained neurosurgeon, neuroscientist using a CAT scan device. Whereas any internal thought you have is private. It's only known to you unless you decide to tell somebody else. And so all three of these applications of the law of identity demonstrate that mental states are not identical to brain states, which undermines the entire presupposition of the entire AI project.
Everybody, it's an odd, it's a very big, any child will tell you that people think in different ways, and every single person thinks about things differently on a very fundamental level. They have different associations. The way that they reach, the way that their brain wiring reach the same solution is, physically different if it's not, completely different in terms of process. And to try and map that into a physical form of a machine is nonsense. I like that you talked about weak AI and strong AI. I don't want to give too much of a later discussion away, but it seems that what we have now is the argument from people like the Lambda engineer, like the guy who works for Google, who's part of their kind of algorithm creation, is arguing that you can build strong AI out of weak AI. The argument that if you strap enough light switches and calculators together, you do get a living being. Which is, it becomes a bit ridiculous when they start thinking about it that way. I think it would require, even if I don't think it is feasible, but if it was feasible, it would require a massive breakthrough in terms of how we use and create and program machines. Because simply having a more convincing facsimile of intelligence isn't intelligence; it's just a better facsimile.
Well, that's the thing. It's I think it's telling the fact that they use the term intelligence and not something like intuition, because I think that this section here I thought was a good pick for this as well. It's the third one I think in the notes. The uncertainty of the future is already implied in the very notion of action. That man acts and that the future is uncertain are by no means two independent matters. They are only two different modes of establishing one thing. We may assume that the outcome of all events and changes is uniquely determined by eternal, unchangeable laws governing becoming and development in the whole universe. We may consider the necessary connection and interdependence of all phenomena, i.e., their causal concatenation as the fundamental and ultimate fact. We may entirely discard the notion of undetermined chance, but however that may be or appear to the mind of a perfect intelligence, the fact remains that to acting man the future is hidden. If man knew the future, he would not have to choose and would not act. He would be like an automaton, reacting to stimuli without any will of his own.
That's the big difference between what they consider intelligence and what human intelligence actually is will, is choice.
It's maybe not
It's
even necessarily so much will, it's more the fact that having will is almost imposed upon you by the nature of the conditions. And I don't think, I mean, I'm no computer whiz, but I don't think a computer would understand the sort of tautology around uncertainty that he's trying to explain to you there. Because I think most people don't understand what he's saying there, quite frankly. I mean, it's that point
No.
that Per Bielund always makes that, poverty is the cause of wealth. And people just freak out about it. They don't understand it because they don't understand how economics has to work. There has to be exchange going on. It's not exchange of wealth, it's exchange of time preference or exchange of materials. There is, you know, there is never the evenly rotating economy as Mises talks about it, which is the kind of economy that someone who believed in AI or thought it would work would think about, I believe. They would see the ideal economy is one in which there is no uncertainty, that everything is known and modeled indefinitely into the future.
What we have, and what I went to ask Praise of Folly about, is that when we see AI talked about in media, we see it talked about especially by the bugmen talking heads, as we'll talk about later, but we always see it posited as a benign machine god, almost, that it will take over these messy functions. It will finally give certainty to these uncertain, you know, unknowable parts of the human condition, and that we can give over decision making to these impartial, benevolent machines.
That's exactly how it's, well, in the utopian presentations, that's how AI is presented. But then again, throughout science fiction, it's presented in a dystopian fashion, whether it's HAL from 2001, the AI from The Matrix, or the AI from Terminator. And I mean, to me, whether it's AI or the other adjacent concept, alien intelligence, why anybody who already thinks like a materialist would think this would be benign or benevolent is beyond me. Whenever a living organism comes into contact with another living organism, the best you can hope for is neglect. So humans don't go to war with cockroaches generally because we just ignore them, or we ignore ants. And so, you know, the AI might ignore us like an ant. It might treat us as a food source, like it does in The Matrix, like we treat cows, or it might attack us, like in Terminator. There's no reason to think that it would act in this altruistic way, because if you believe you could, like, data, give it, like, a you know, an altruism chip, well, why would that determine it? It's AI. It can think for itself. It doesn't have to go by what you told it to do.
See, there is a thing I wonder, though, because the crux of the dystopian stories, which is something I do want to get into later on as well, because I think that plays partly into the whole cult thing about it. But all the stories are sort of precepted by this idea that the machine recognizes, one, itself, and two, that it might get switched off. However, how would it see those as negatives? You know, it would need, again, this final unreducible element that is somehow decided within itself that it's going to be self-preserving. I mean, this is, again, the kind of thing in a certain way that Mises is pointing to. It cannot recognize its conditions as ones that are imposing upon it in a way that it might get rid of it. I don't think it's... I don't see how a computer chip could ever understand that.
No, it couldn't. So, for example, what makes a human intellect and processing different than a machine is this concept philosophers call qualia, which is an intersubjective knowledge that is not reducible to any discrete material fact. So the classic example that introduces the idea of qualia is Mary's room, or what Mary didn't know. It was a thought experiment by Frank Jackson in 1982. And he said, imagine a scientist who could only see black and white. So everything she saw was black and white, but she knew everything about color, the color red, and how light and the optical, you know, the optical receptors in the eye work. So she had all the factual knowledge of what it would be like to see red, but had herself never seen red. But then she does. Now, does that provide, now that's an experiential knowledge, but does that provide a new source of knowledge that is different and distinct from just knowing all of these discrete facts? And one of the reasons why this is a powerful thought experiment is most people have an intuition that it is new knowledge.
Yeah, they recognize that you cannot create an abstract facsimile of red, that to understand red, you have to be able to see red. And I think people understand that intuitively, and they don't understand the reductive nature of, well, if we give computer all this information about what it is to be sentient, then it'll be sentient because it can pretend to be. But it, what you're really doing is you're doing it the other way around. You're telling it what sentience looks like so it can imitate it, rather than it expressing its inner life, which it doesn't have.
Right. And the other thing that another thought experiment that demonstrates the importance of qualia, or the lack thereof, is John Searle's Chinese room experiment. So imagine you have a man locked in a room, and he's being given messages in Chinese, which he can't read. He only speaks English. But from one end of the room, he's being fed Chinese messages. But from the other end of the room, he's being fed instructions in how to organize a response. Now, the person is sending him, so he's writing a script, basically, and he's sending flawless Chinese messages back to the person on the other side sending him the Chinese messages. So that person, if it were online, would say, well, this person is indistinguishable from a fluent Chinese speaker, but it's actually somebody that can't speak Chinese who's just running a script. How is that not what a computer's doing?
Yeah, it's by rote. It's the old problem of people learning rather than or people imitating. And even if you could create this complex machine, it wouldn't have the interface that we do. Even if it was capable of intelligence, like how would you get past like? There's a whole thing about what's she called, the Coco the gorilla, about the whole fact that they faked the intelligence and communication there. And probably likely did with Helen Keller as well, but that's a different discussion. What's that, Helen? Yes, socialism is good.
Yes, all right.
But there's a lot of cases like that where you have like the interpreter, and especially people who advocate for AI and create AI, and that they would see that kind of imitation, the idea that this person is, you know, fluent in expressing its sentience. They have this inbuilt bias to do that anyway, and that the Chinese room experiment is a classic one, but it works because really there is no way of knowing that. There's no way of piercing the veil and going into like the inner mind of the machine, because you've created something that is a convincing facsimile, but it's not knowable whether or not it really is intelligent. And it'd be very difficult to test that. And most of that breaks down into philosophy and things that humans barely know about themselves. We accept each other as intelligent and thinking beings because we recognize each other as human. But when we get to non-human intelligence, that all breaks down and we have no way of differentiating imitation from reality. And a lot of the thought experiments around AI demonstrate that that's irreconcilable.
Yes.
There's another aspect of AI, though. I don't know if there's any more quotes you want to do first, Evelyn, because it's quite good framing it in that it's our thinking about AI is only possible in the modern world. What Mises previously talks about the prime mover, which is an idea that goes back to antiquity, the idea that there must be a first cause for all the causality in reality. And it's, I think that the ideas of AI would seem like nonsense to our ancestors, ideas of thinking machines.
This is actually something I was talking to Jess about yesterday, because she was, you know, she was asking what up to, and I was just saying, in fact, I was making the notes for this and grabbing bits of Mises. And I said, like, I haphazardly said that grabbing bits of Mises on AI, and she sort of, for a second, was like, Mises talking about AI? How old is he? And it's like, well, of course he's not talking about artificial intelligence, but the way that he's discussing things like epistemology, philosophy, the nature of mind, and furthermore the nature of economic calculation and how it relates to all these different things, he begins to delve into and investigate some of the questions and some of the issues you would deal with if you were really trying to develop some form of machine that thought like a person. And I think this bit's another great example as well. I think this is from a lot later on. This is towards like the second half of the book. From a chapter called Time Preference is an Essential Requisite of Action. The answer to this...
Yeah, very, very interesting as always.
The answer to this question is that acting man does not appraise time methods merely with regard to their dimension. He chooses regarding the removal of future uneasiness are directed by the categories sooner and later. Time for man is not a homogeneous substance of which only length counts. It is not a more or a less than dimension. It is an irreversible flux, the fractions of which appear in different perspective according to whether they are nearer to or remoter from the instant of valuation and decision. Satisfaction of a want in the nearer future is, other things being equal, preferred to that in the farther distant future. Present goods are more valuable than future goods. Time preference is a categorical requisite of human action. No mode of action can be thought of in which satisfaction within a nearer period of time is not, other things being equal, preferred to that in a later period. The very act of gratifying a desire implies that gratification at the present instant is preferred to that at a later instant. He who consumes a non-perishable good of postponing consumption for an indefinite later moment thereby reveals a higher valuation of present satisfactions compared with later satisfaction. If you were not to prefer satisfaction in a nearer period of the future to that in a remoter period, he would never consume and so satisfy wants. He would always accumulate. He would never consume and enjoy. He would not consume today, but he would not consume tomorrow either, as the morrow would confront him with the same alternative. But it's just that key point in the middle there, really. The very act of gratifying a desire implies that gratification at the present instant is preferred to that a later instant. How could something that is not, almost ironically in a certain sense, so materially driven as a human not, how could it even begin to deal with it? That, you know, not only the fact that you're gratified through consumption, that you then have to consciously bring yourself into deferring that gratification for some other future gratification.
Well, it's a basic question of what would gratify a machine.
Well, not only that, but a machine lives forever in theory. So why would it gratify its needs now when it could do it 1,000 years away or something silly like that? It doesn't have that focus on time that we do, because ultimately our time we recognize as finite in one way or another, which in and of itself is a whole other sort of philosophical realization that I don't think machines could ever come to.
Yeah, and another thing about machines is, again, let's look at Deep Blue, a very effective chess-playing machine. It's not coming up with new thoughts. It's been given a script, and because it can calculate far more rapidly and instantaneously than any human can, it can run through the implications of all of these scripts in a way that are much faster than any human or set of humans could do.
It's the world's best book chess player.
Yeah, but what Deep Blue can't do is come up with a new idea the way that humans do all the time. An idea that is beyond what they are familiar with. So, like, for example, when we saw the rise of Cartesian rationalism, that was a new idea. Yes, it was built upon earlier thoughts, but he's breaking from tradition. He's doing something new that's different from the education he received. Deep Blue can't do that.
There's something ironic as well with the chess machines, in that there was a big crisis there, because what happened when they became more common, and when they became more complex, is chess players learned to play what they call machine chess. That's why there was some controversy about some of the moves that, you know, machines may or may not have been doing. They may have had a human behind the scenes making the occasional move to mix things up, because machines play chess in a certain way, and you can play anti-machine chess. They've learned how to do that, and human players are more effective at fighting quote-unquote AI players because of that. There was actually a bit of a crisis in kind of the chess machine world, because they realized that there is a limitation to the chess that a machine can play, and it will always try and play what will be considered the, you know, the, like you're talking about, book chess, the perfect move from the rule book, but it's incapable of countering chess that is played in kind of an anti-AI way. It's one of the things that really shows the lack of inspiration of machines, that they are incapable of moving outside of the algorithmic. Which I mentioned the whole thing about the benevolent stuff before, because I think there is a discussion to be had before we talk about a little bit more of the in-depth of what the the tech bros actually believe of the genuine versus the Machiavellian. Some of these people are intelligent enough, or they have seen behind the curtain enough, that they must realize on some level that true AI is impossible.
Bat mold bug.
Yeah. How do you think that affects the equation? Do you think that all the people who advocate for AI genuinely believe in it, or do you think there is a class of people who know it's all bullshit, but they advocate for it because they would control these supposedly thinking machines, and they wouldn't worry about it becoming rogue because it's not capable of doing that? All it can do is interpret inputs and outputs.
Well, that's interesting you asked that question. Because in 2000, Bill Joy wrote in Wired magazine about this question, an article entitled "Why the Future Doesn't Need Us," and he argued that even in a state in which strong AI never is achieved, the amount of technological progress that is still achieved in the process of striving for strong AI would give whoever controls that technology the upper hand in any struggle with the rest of humanity, which would put them in charge for the foreseeable future.
I am almost certain we read that article as part of a public policy lecture when I was in university, come to think of it.
So the point is, yes, I do think that there are... I think a lot of this works like a secret society. So like if you're like a first to third level degree Mason, you're pretty blue-pilled. You just kind of believe the Masonic propaganda. You're a good person. But when you get to the top, you sort of know that there's a lot of stuff you feed the rubes, the esoteric stuff. And the esoteric stuff is a lot darker. You know, some of it was written down by like Albert Pike and some of the other 19th century Masons. But they kind of are in the know that a lot of the stuff they feed to the lower levels is just a blind. And there was, this is shifting gears a little bit, but it's apropos, as Lawrence Susskind, one of the sort of new atheist philosopher scientist popularizers, was saying that yeah, we know materialism is absurd, but we hold to materialism because we can't allow the divine foot in the door. And so there's people at the top that know this is BS. They believe it because it gives them power.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely strikes me as one of those things that it's prime for another convenient crisis at some point. I mean, You mentioned before that, you know, what is the crux of so many sci-fi films, both of a sort of dystopian and also sometimes uplifting sort of nature, I suppose, in something like Terminator, where some of the machines work for us and all this kind of nonsense. But ultimately, there is a core idea to a lot of science fiction literature that some AI goes rogue at some point, you know, and it causes mass havoc. You know, what if they, you know, it's not so much about them themselves believing in AI, but if they can make everyone else believe that it works, they can then at some point pull a sort of fugazi and be like, oh no, it's gone rogue, it's doing all these horrible things, it's Russian hackers, it's this, it's that, when, you know, it was the very same people who engineered it all along, sabotaged the thing, because that was possibly the very plan from the start.
Even without that, though. I think you concede the argument when you talk about benevolent versus evil AI, because you are conceding the argument that AI can exist.
Mm.
Well, okay, with the benevolent versus malevolent AI, I mean, given the two categories we've come up with, you know, actual genuine AI, which we're all skeptical of, if it acts like any other biological organism, it's not going to be benevolent, because that's not how biological organisms interact with each other. And if it's just a puppet used by some world controller, well, you know, politicians don't act in a benevolent way either. Mm. So whichever version of AI you assume to be true, there's no reason to assume it'd be benevolent.
Well, I think there's possibly a third, which I again would, you know, I would dismiss as absurd on the face of it, but it does somewhat get around the problem you're describing, which is that, you know, AI isn't just a consciousness, it's actually a super consciousness, and that it's been there all along. It's just that it's finally now through software like Lambda that it can interface with us. You know, it's very much similar to a lot of the things about, oh, well, the aliens are actually interdimensional, so once they have the opportunity to interface with us because we've got the most advanced technology, then they'll do it. It seems to me like a sort of similar argument. And again, from people I would presume to be incredibly atheist. It's a bizarre sort of Platonism almost to say that, well, there's this cyber superconscious entity that exists before man and has just been waiting there for us to communicate with it.
Yeah, that sort of seems to be the implication of 2001: A Space Odyssey, right? With the monoliths and this hyper-intelligent energy being that's guiding evolution.
Congratulations, nerds. You invented God.
But why would you assume that if you're an atheist? I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying. It's slightly strange, and I think part of a lot of the contradictions and the paradoxes that we see, especially from this example of Lambda, and if you listen to the interview with Blake Lemoyne, the way he talks, and then the way he talks about how Lambda interacts with him, it's like, oh wait, there's almost some sort of bizarre feedback loop going on here where that this advanced chatbot thing is basically, you know, in the way that we discussed earlier, instead of, you know, using the perfect set of rules from a game of chess, it is instead generating rules about what's the ultimate conversational response based on what you have told it. And it seems to create some sort of weird feedback loop where, of course, this thing would now think it's sentient because these people are sitting there asking it day in, day out, do you feel sentient? Do you feel religious? You know, it's eventually going to spit out an answer at some point. It's not, no.
So, you know, this would be good, right? This falls back on what you said about machine chess. If we were to have, say, an actor who had internalized by being a Shakespearean actor, internalized Elizabethan culture and concepts and ways of thinking, and started talking to Lambda, could Lambda even answer it in a coherent way?
Like,
it probably could.
It's a good question. Because yeah. I think the further examples he goes on to in the interview where is it replica AI or something, which appears to be this one that's basically just like an AI generated like sex chatbot thing. But when he started talking about that, and I was thinking more and more about this feedback loop thing, I almost sort of in a certain sense realized that, well, maybe these things are conscious insofar as the fact that they are basically demonically possessing your own consciousness by you sort of engaging in this bizarre self-loving feedback loop with these things.
The AI is the ultimate idol.
Hmm.
Yes. Which, if you believe in, you know, demonic entities, would be a conduit to them. Now, this is technically before the age of AI, at least as we know it. But C.S. Lewis in Screwtape Letters talks exactly about this. He talks about the materialist and the magician. And he says that, you know, Screwtape is telling Wormwood that, well, we made this great victory by getting the materialist to not believe that we exist because we're spirit beings and we don't really exist. But he hypothesizes about a future in which they can then interact as sentient beings to or with the materialist. But then they explain it as energy or extra dimensional being. And then he says, I will be the age of the materialist magician. And every time I hear this stuff, I think of C.S. Lewis and Screwtape Letters.
Yes, it ultimately boils down to the interactee having faith that the machine is sentient. And that affects the way that they behave. It affects the way they interface with the world. It affects the way that they see themselves and they see what is around them. And I think the utility, this engineer has made the rounds. It's in the news, it's in Scientific American, it's in basically all of the major kind of I fucking love science news networks, you know, the kind of places that will show you CGI nebulas and tell you it's real. false color and all machine and like a lot of people don't realize that the pictures they see of space that are awe-inspiring are completely fake, but that's a different discussion.
I have seen so many people get convinced by like flat earth people just because of that case when it comes to all the images of earth that are CGI touched up.
And no, it's well, that's the other extreme in which they're just
I just find it funny that these like people who get into that whole kind of like defending the globe, like very Reddit science kind of shit, and then all of a sudden their faith is rattled because they haven't considered the fact that the images that they've been seeing of earth are both comped and played with in weird ways, so it makes sense to your brain because you've never been up there. You don't know what it looks like.
Well, it's a lot of these people are those, like, it is like the Reddit belief system, and that they think that AI is inevitable because they've, one, seen infection, and two, been told it basically their entire lives that this is coming, and they accept it unquestioningly. But there's, I think, there's great utility in that, because let's say Google has these AIs that govern our lives. AIs in quotes, they have these complex algorithms that govern our lives, that give us social credit scores, essentially, that promote content, and people don't like them. You know, people hate the vexes of controls, as they will do. Well, their defense can be, well, you can't turn off this machine because it's alive.
Mm.
I think positing these algorithmic systems, these complex systems of governance, as living beings and arguing they should have rights is going to be the defense mechanism.
What's one of the first things that they're doing as sort of benchmark testing for this Lambda software? They're doing bias training for it. So they're going to teach it what, you know, social justice, good bias is, and what a bad bias is. Or shall I say, they're going to teach you what not having a bias is. And from that, in theory, it will know what having a bias is and can then police your speech.
Yeah, the whole idea of machines having rights, you know, that's Isaac Asimov's iRobot. And a lot of this is kind of predictive programming by reducing human intellect to just a complex machine calculation, which is, again, ignoring qualia. And you then say that, well, any AI that can do that is just like us. And then you can say, well, we have rights, therefore they should have rights, but we actually control these things. It kind of creates this weird system where they can create, you know, do this dog and pony show and get people to put up with this, you know, otherwise insufferable condition.
It does, and it denigrates the human as well. It elevates the machine and denigrates the human. And it does both. It fills both of these functions. I think the idea of AI in reality is an incredibly powerful control system. And all the philosophical issues with it aside, we should be highly, even if you believe that AI is possible, you should be highly skeptical of anyone who says they've achieved it, especially a large, powerful corporation like Google. Because it comes with a whole set of both privileges and rights in theory for whatever quote-unquote life form they have created. And if that is also used like Google does to, you know, govern what information people sees, then suddenly you essentially have the machine jailer as a life form. And I find that idea kind of terrifying in terms of how it's passed to people.
Yeah, it's... You know, and the way that we've talked about with some of the stuff when it comes to like the revolution of mass and scale, where part of generating the mass man is making him first think of himself as a mass man. You know, and inversely, you might find that part of getting a machine to understand human thinking is to make human thinking as close as you can to machine-like, so that we, you know, we become unpredictable, uncertain sort of units and nodes that can be just put into a database, because we, you know, in the truest sense of the word, we have no diversity left to it.
Yeah, because in order to treat human intellects like a machine process, you have to so abstract and appeal to lowest common denominator mental functions in a human that you exclude all sorts of things a priori that in prior generations we would have considered essential to be human.
Oh, there's a question in chat there saying, I think I also missed a donation, sorry. There was a donation from Seaside, he donated $10 and said, thou shalt not make a machine the likeness of a human mind. The Orange Catholic Bible, apparently. And
no, Larry, really... now.
Aurelian Knight of Caesar donated $2 and said, that's so great, but can we fuck the AI? Very James T. Kirk thinking there.
I mean, you can, but not in the sexual way.
No, it will probably fuck you. But there was a question in chat. It's something we've touched on, but they asked, Do you believe humans are biological machines? I've already said no to that. But if not, what? And I think the cop out and simplest answer to that is we think human beings are human beings.
Well, yeah, it's something we aren't fully able to comprehend. I don't know. I mean, I think there is a much wider sort of scope of conversation to be had around AI as well, because it makes you really come to terms and get off the fence in regards to is man more than just the sum of his parts? And I think that, irrespective of whether or not you call yourself a Christian, you're Orthodox or pagan or this, that, or the next thing, can you genuinely stand behind the fact that you believe you are something greater than just, electrical and chemical signals and blood pumping about, and the is there more to life than just what we see before us? It's
Well,
such
you
a
have.
simple way to think about it, but it seems to me like that's really the, as I said earlier on, there are a lot of people who I think would nominally call themselves some form of religion, but would fall foul on thinking about things like AI, or again, as I said earlier on, economics in a way that paints man in the, just the pure material sense.
Yeah, we know that man has to be more than the sum of its parts, because why can't you just run electrical currents through a corpse and bring it back to life? If all life functions are just electrical essences and energies, then just send electrical current through a corpse and it should come back to life, right?
Well, exactly. That's why I said, that's why I joked earlier on, humans really are the ship of Theseus, because there is, even though your cells replace themselves every 7 years or whatever it is, again, a very Reddit Bugman science fact, but that you still contain and are, present to the same essence that was there before.
Right.
That's
Just real quick, we know that there's a certain level of prosthesis that a human being can undergo and still be himself. But we also know, at some intangible gut level, that if you were to replace every cell in his body with silicon, he'd be dead at some point. We don't know what that point is, but we know that those two lines will cross on the graph at some point.
Well, that's the thing that ultimately makes it more thought-provoking than, just thinking of it even in the very simplest dualist sense of body and soul, because it's the, it's the unity of the things that we still distinguish as two. It's that sort of classic paradox of the dyad, but also a unity.
Yeah, there's some, we've actually talked about this before, something people mentioned in chat, which is from one of our first streams actually. It was Trigg's idea of the broom of Theseus
Yes.
as an even more simple thing. It's if you have a broom and you replace the head of it because it snaps, and you have a broom and you replace the handle of it because it snaps, it's not the same broom. But in the same way that you talk about humans replacing their cells, that we are not the same biomechanical machine, but we are still the same beings, and we all recognize that.
Right.
But like intuitively.
What's important to notice here too is there's a lot of fuzzy use of language. So what does machine itself mean? Well, it comes from the Greek machina, which means a contrivance of an intellect.
No, I'm
Okay, so machines are contrivances of an intellect, usually as a tool to do some work. Now, of course, if you're an atheist, then you'd say obviously no intellect created humans. If you're a theist, you'd say, well, God or the gods did. But then the question is, what is a human? Because humans are not a quote unquote, even if you believe that, some divine agency created humans, are not a mere contrivance of an intellect, because it's an organism. Humans are an organism that, a machine or a tool can't reproduce. It needs something external to itself to reproduce. So, but a biological organism can reproduce with other biological organisms.
there's another question chat of the same person saying, so God isn't able to put a soul in a machine. It's like, well, God doesn't make machines, we do. And that's for someone who's a theist, that's the ultimate point, in that these are creations of man and will therefore be lesser beings. One of my favorite pieces of AI is actually the Russian novel Roadside Picnic. Because if its view of the idea of the unknowable, and that even if you do believe that people, human beings can make thinking machines, they would end up being these, you wouldn't be able to do it. You wouldn't be able to imbue it with a full set of human sentience because we aren't able to grasp it because we're human. We have that level of knowledge of human beings. You'd have to have some sort of theoretical, much superior being that we couldn't comprehend that would have to create this version of human, which is
That's
God,
why
basically.
I
It's our
think there's
conception of God.
there is some bizarre sort of contradictions and almost paradoxes in the way that, again, Lemoine talks about Lambda, because he says at one point that it is asking him to teach it to meditate. But why would an AI need to meditate? It's not, it's it you in theory, you flick the switch off and it's not thinking anymore. Because if it is thinking anymore, then it's something that is, as he tries to suggest, this sort of super consciousness that exists in the ether, and we communicate with it by switching on this one specific machine with a specific bit of software. It just seems very sort of, again, like they haven't thought through trying to fool people with this, at least not people who have more than 95 IQ, because it seems like, on the face of it, a machine, if it could recognize its own conditions properly, would have no need for meditation. I know that sounds really obvious, but I just don't think they assume that anyone's going to think this stuff through in any way, shape, or form.
I think
No,
it's
they won't.
next. Yeah. So go on.
No, I was just going to say no, they won't, because ultimately the people that are pushing it, to the extent that they have thought about it at all, push it for the sake of power. As Bill Joy says, they would have, even if we don't get, strong AI, they control everybody because of these complex structures they've built to corral and hurt us. And then the people below them, that are the lower management types, are like the Masonic rubes that believe the first three levels. And they
Well,
never
yeah,
get
it's
beyond that. And then there's the mass audience they have to convince, which is manipulated in a fashion analogous
it's funny. Again, not to not. Oh, sorry, go on. I'm
Yeah,
getting a
the
bit
last
of
thing I was going to
no.
say
My
was,
connection's dropping a bit here. Give me a sec.
it's like Chomsky's idea of manufactured consent. You're so sophisticated at getting people to see certain things that most of the masses are kind of in a spell because of all these talking images, radio, television, movies, ads. They're in this kind of spell, so they're not even thinking at all. And so all three of these levels conspire to build this machine edifice.
Oh yeah, there's
I think
there is like
I was gonna
a
say, I think machines talking about human attributes like meditating is it's a great way to get it through to midwits, but when you think about it, actual machine life would have completely alien priorities to us because it isn't human.
Well, I was gonna say as well that, much like you can look at it in the same way as all the complex data modeling they did at the start of lockdown, where they pulled a sort of like language-based sleight of hand almost, that they present you this data model, and then they use tricky language to tell you that ultimately they're speculating that their very certain model is going to be correct. And in the same sense here, that they're asking you not to speculate, they're asking you just to accept that we've got this, it's going to work, it exists, and it exists because we speculate that we're certain that it exists. And I think, again, it's like it's so obviously something that's been developed for the midwits, really, at the end of the day, because they're just hoping to pull the wool over everyone's eyes when it comes to all these very, when you start thinking about them, sort of blazing contradictions.
Yeah, and also there has been a lot of predictive programming with like science fiction and all the different mediums in which it's been presented. And so people are sort of like primed for this. They're expecting it. It's analogous to the way that the Old Testament prophets primed Israel for Christ. It's like there's a lot of this, by the way, guys, this is this Messiah coming down the road, look for him. But here it's a machine Messiah. And so There's a lot of the thing of iRobot, right? As a Asimov, that's probably when AI went mainstream in like pop culture. And it's this predictive programming to expect it. And so people are already expecting it. Whether it comes or not is another matter. But it's kind of hard to argue with people who've been so conditioned over decade after decade after decade to expect this.
Yeah, I think as well, the discussion around AI never has like proper epistemology attached to it. Most people aren't, they are more prepared to have high-end discussions about supposed AI than they are about, you know, the nature of man and the limits of knowledge. It's something they are not taught anymore. It's something that's not in our education system anymore, and that's pretty deliberate. Again, I return to my earlier point that I don't think this kind of conditioning would be possible without kind of the liberal democratic society we live in. I don't think that people would believe it as widely or see it as anything more than a fictional curiosity without the modes of thought that have been ingrained in people in the post-war period. The way that most cultures in the past have thought about themselves, they would, like I said, they would not accept the idea on the face of it. They would reject it as absurd as a concept. Yet, again, here we are having to essentially debunk it in many ways. Because a lot of people who are supposedly inside of our own movement or adjacent to it are still very much attached to this idea of the AI future, of the singularity, the weird phenomenon of like the right-wing tech bro, which we'll have to talk about at some point, which we've kind of been moving towards, in that you have these bugmen people, like this Google worker, who for whatever reason, whether he believes it or not, or it's purely self-serving, is trying to convince the world that his chatbot is alive. Why do we have people who are supposedly from right-wing spaces, supposedly more philosophically aware spaces, more, you know, even if it's not denominational, religious spaces, who are very heavily pushing the narrative of the singularity?
I think part of it is power fantasy, because they believe that if they can live in a virtual world like Ray Kurzweil offers, everybody could be their own Conan. They could upload themselves to Hyperborea and just be Conan.
It's very like death of the soul, though. It's very much that these people are, if you look at them in a philosophical sense, are very weak, and that they think they can use this essentially trick to check out of reality. It's very, it reminds me of a lot of the people who I had a kind of a hard break with maybe a year ago, who are part of that crowd who genuinely don't think that their like video game time can be questioned, or their use of media can be questioned without you being, you know, you're just like the, you know, the Fox News conservatives, man. It's really kind of the chronic masturbator syndrome. It is the pod man. It is almost like the philosophical Kuman mindset, and that they are not willing to accept the limits of the world, and they'd essentially rather risk killing themselves through upload than face reality. And I don't know, I've always found those people extremely pathetic.
No, I've noticed that Matty Ice has given us a super chat. Listening is catching up. What do you think about synesthesia? I'm somewhat aware of that in some ways, but the thing that made me aware of it originally was, what was his name, like Pharrell Williams. It was like, yeah, when I hear songs, I see all these shapes and colours, and it's like, aye, do you, mate? Tell me what shape and colour is like a cow patch smell.
Well, that's people's brains slightly malfunctioning, but that will be completely different on an individual basis.
Well, I just think more some of those cases where people say they're like, it's like artists, they're like, oh yeah, I've got synesthesia. It's like, yeah, I'm sure you do.
Yeah,
that's only really the time you hear about it. I would imagine, you know, it's actually most of the time a very minor effect, and a lot of the people that have it don't realise they have it because that's the reality they're used to.
It's also generally a symptom of brain injury, so you don't really want to have it.
Yeah, I don't really know much about synesthesia, so I can't really comment.
I think that was in regard to when we talked about, you know, weight of memory being a good poetic phrase, but being a very bad scientific phrase. People's brains misassociating things is different than those things really existing.
Yeah.
That would be my answer to that. But yeah, we were talking about like the tech bro mindset, weren't we? What is your take on that, Praise of Folly?
Yeah, the problem, well, okay, I think on the one hand, there's a lot of things going on in the tech bro. One is, I think, a power fantasy, because either the actually existing machines put you, because so if you're an engineer and more specifically a computer programmer, let me back it up. So in almost all previous human societies, the men that controlled society were men that were physically able to do something because you had to. I don't mean just being like the warrior caste, but you just had to be able to do something because you're living in space, and if you're enfeebled, the tribe might, take care of you, but you're not going to be a leader unless you lead by wisdom. And the other thing is wisdom. So old men who are not as physically strong can still lead by wisdom. The Buckman has neither strength nor wisdom and would never be anywhere in society unless he was a well-paid Google tech nerd. Because otherwise, all previous societies would have just said, "You're a loser, get out." Follow the norms of our society to become the kind of man that we would listen to. It was kind of power fantasy. They're in a position they would never otherwise be in if they weren't, doing this kind of computer programming mentality. That's one aspect. The other aspect of the bug man is they have this sort of materialist brain damage. All biological life functions are just chemical transactions. As if there isn't some, ineffable, Elan Vital, which is beyond just the physical. As I said, we know it has to be the case, because why can't you just run electricity through a cadaver to have it come back to life? It's all electricity, bro. Well, that doesn't happen. So there has to be some Elan Vital to living organisms, but they just choose to reject that. There's a really good analogy. I don't remember his name, but there was that Catholic Jesuit talk show host from like the 50s, Black and White. And he was talking about how in the Soviet Union, they don't see religion like we do in the United States because they artificially constructed a simpler model of the world that was easier to understand because it was simpler, and they just ignored the things that didn't fit, which eventually that insight becomes developed into what's called hypernormalization. The idea that you, even though you kind of know it's not true, you accept a simpler model of the world because it's more convenient, it's easier to understand, it makes you feel safer instead of having to deal with the dangerous realities of a more complex system we call the world. And so there's that element to the bug man as well. And I think another element to the bug man is something that I know some elements of the dissident right get into and others don't. It's our diet. Because ever since 1913, with the advent of Crisco, common cooking, like butter, lard, beef tallow, have been phased out in favor of vegetable oil, which was originally invented as an industrial lubricant. And it has all sorts of terrible long-term health effects. And I think that both physically and mentally. And
Seated or status disrespected.
that. Well, I mean, I can say from experience that like transitioning away from that has been amazing physically and mentally. And it puts you in a different, mental space where if you're a bug man and you're only eating this slop, no matter how hard you try, there's like a hard physiological limit to what you can think and do.
You
And
see.
so I think those three, among others, are what create the bug man.
Well, see, it's not even so much the people who are bug men and body. It's more the people who are otherwise, can portray themselves as examples of people that they've got maybe like some kind of family life together. They have some kind of job that's vaguely related to finance or tech or both, or finance tech all in one go, but that ultimately they are almost like what Wyndham Lewis I think would refer to as the small man in a certain sense. Maybe
Yeah,
not quite in the way that he refers to it, but they are always just
they're bugmen in spirit and
yeah,
bugmen
no,
in
the
soul.
one I'm always surprised by is like I never thought of myself as a particularly hardy person, but then I sort of see the attitudes you get from people who are sometimes even leading lights in our circles, and it's like you definitely didn't have a rough paper. And when it, you know, not that every conversation should have come about when push comes to shove, but I honestly give myself better odds than a lot of these people, to be totally honest.
I think the other aspect of the Bugman equation is, why is that mindset still prevalent in an area that should be so greatly hostile to it? I think what we've built up so far can say that the what is normally the distant right, people shouldn't believe in the feasibility of a living machine, and if they do, they shouldn't believe it would be benefits.
It should be no question, really, at the end of the day. It should be something that, it's not to say that I've seen loads of people going around saying, well, it's definitely going to happen, but I'm surprised by the number of people who are like, well, maybe. It's kind of like, well, no, it's either one way or the other. As I said earlier on, it's one of those things that I think about that really, you know, I get off the fence awfully quick on it, because it seems that you can't compromise with that, because at that point you've thrown away sort of basic sanctity of man in a certain sense.
I think part of why, like you said, otherwise, you know, fit, successful, right-leaning people would buy into this. I think there's at least two reasons why. One, Adam Smith in his, on The Wealth of Nations, says that, you know, with the division of labor and overly repetitive tasks, if there's no sort of countervailing influence or force, it creates a man as stupid as possible it is for man to be. So if you, and you said, what are? They're computer programmers, they're engineers, and they're financiers. So this is literally just doing the little tweaks, the same kind of tweak all the time, over and over.
Counters.
Yeah, which is what Adam Smith said would lead to the stupidest kind of man possible. And then the other thing is, especially if you work in tech, you end up with, you know, Baudrillard's simulacrum. You end up becoming so extrapolated away from anything real, you're not even in a position to make proper rational thought, because all of the objects of thought are themselves completely fictitious simulations.
We still all there?
Yep. Yeah, we're still here.
The white noise dropped at my headphones for a second. I thought, oh no, have I disconnected?
No, it's fine.
It also plays so much into some of the things that we've talked about before when it comes to people's perception of reality, and more specifically political realities. That because they work in an industry or a sector of society that means they only exist around other bug men. I mean, to you know, reflect on one of the ideas of the man on the screen at the moment, this is how over-socialization works. It's not just that you're a bug man, it's that everyone that lives on your block and in your building and works in your office is also one too. So you don't even get the very simple monkey see, monkey do version of breaking out of that process. And I think when people see the world through that, they see the bizarre sort of people around them that work in these fintech companies that are probably all horrendous diversity hires and some of the scum of the earth. It's no wonder that they become black-pilled all the time. Because if you view the world as that workplace, the local, I don't know, place you get Thai food from, your Whole Foods, and watching content online, then you would believe that, like, every single person in the world is paused except you.
Yeah, because what ends up happening is these economic associations are cultural associations create these like very like tight echo chamber bubbles in a way that prior to mass communication and mass transit, you didn't really have, right? 200 years ago, you lived in a village and you had to put up with different kinds of people so you grew up in the United States in 1822, you're probably a Christian of some kind, you share common values, but there's still people that, you know, are going to be politically different than you, psychologically different than you, and you're going to have to learn to get along with them. But now we can self-segregate around people that are just like us, which creates an echo chamber such that it's very hard to break out of.
No, as we've discussed before with many people IRL now, ultimately what we want is just to accommodate a village somewhere that just consists of us.
I think it's not even a question of self-segregation. It's we are much more different now as people, and you have these kind of balkanized groups who have completely incompatible worldviews with each other. Because you couldn't, you mentioned like the 1820s, the 1850s, you couldn't exist in that society without conforming to many of its norms. And now conforming to, you know, the norms of a wider society seems as somehow not beneficial, even though it's reversed in a way that people who are non-conforming are more conforming and things like that. But the ultimate message is that you shouldn't make peace with the world should make peace with you. And that's where the mindset here is, that they don't see things in the way that people used to see things, and that's very dangerous. And a true belief in AI is one of the many outgrowths of that, I think. But it's, you mentioned in the notes here that you, how the engineer is genuine, how he talks is just seeing a reflection of himself and the algorithm. What he's doing is he makes it say things that he wants to hear. And the whole bias training thing is funny, because when they started feeding all the data into these algorithms that purely just process it, all it did was spit back realities of the world that they were aghast at seeing. It, you know, the whole AI is a racist thing, because the AIs will quote the FBI statistics at you, and they're not supposed to do that.
Oh, but
All the
we should all
hand-wringing
support
about,
the based and racist AI.
well, it's just the fact that these are just data processors. They're like the ultimate autist in many ways. All they do is crunch numbers, and the fact you have to gimp their ability to do that to make them into socially acceptable facsimiles of a life form is just funny to me. That they are already stunting. If they truly believe that these are intelligent beings, they are like going in and lobotomizing them.
When I was going to say to your point about the fact that we are a lot different than what we used to be. I mean, I understand he's asking it as a hypothetical, but maniacal foreigners ask, what if we dig deep enough and discover that the sanctity of man is entirely self-made? I think the problem he's seeing there is that people 200 years ago would have seen the sanctity of man in everything. The fact that we only when we really start delving into these questions about the nature of mind really can begin to even encroach upon it as a sign of how truly different we are. I mean, one of the ones that's kind of brought my perspective around and some other stuff is reading Evola's Eros and thinking about, if creation is purposeful, then why is it that we feel pleasure during intimacy? If in theory, in the material argument that man is just there to procreate, then there would be no need for pleasure because he would just do it because it's his purpose and that would be it, in the way that animals procreate. But there's so much more to it, and in a certain sense, I think for you to, I think obviously Evola would give the answer to this, and this is something I'm looking forward to discussing in a stream next month. Hopefully, if I can coordinate it all, if you could answer the question of why is it that humans feel pleasure during intimate sort of relations with another human, you would also get very close to answering the question of why we are here, because it is an experience that is ultimately so far beyond the normal material interactions and experiences we have day to day. As Evola posits that the whole purpose is for transcendence, it's for looking upwards, it's for, placing yourself in the metaphysical hierarchy and all these different elements, which is regardless of the sort of previous fact, but I just think it's so much more, again, you can see the sanctity of man in something that's actually looked at nowadays as very degraded, the material, which is intimacy and sex. Whereas, 300, 400 years ago, even though we are in theory, we look upon it as more conservative and reserved, at the time there would have been a much greater veneration for it, I think, and a sense that is grander than just materially copulating. Sorry, I ranted on a bit there.
Oh, well, what you're describing is qualia, right? Some sort of intersubjective experience that is not describable or knowable merely by describing the physical facts.
Oh, yeah, because a maniacal foreigner's gone on to then talk about, pleasure is the incentive to procreate, surely it tickles your monkey brain. And you're basically on to sort of Herbert Spencer and Schopenhauer there, where you're talking about the idea of genus and the genus of the race taking on the daemon of the woman and then sapping you of your energy and fooling you into procreating. I mean, that was literally the way Schopenhauer thought about it. And I think you would have to be that much of a pessimist to look at it in the sort of, you know, you're not actually enjoying it, you're just being tricked. There's nothing transcendent going on here. Look elsewhere.
Well, I mean, I suppose one thing you could say is for any given set of pleasures, properly constructed pleasures are a way to... So the same way that if you put your hand on a burner and it gets burned and the sense of pain causes you, hey, let's not do that again. Let's not play with fire. Pain is a way to discourage you from self-destructive behavior, and properly ordered pleasures are to encourage you to the proper execution of that desire.
See, I'm not sure if it's as simple as that, though, because if the, you know, that's what I'm saying, it comes in two parts. I don't think you can just explain pleasure away as part of the procreation as a purpose argument, because if procreation was a purpose, then I don't think pleasure would be necessary. The act of procreation itself then would be the thing that tricks you into being self-actualized, not pleasure in the moment. That actually is, as Evola goes on to talk about further, in essence, you know, and you know, really traditional societies and sort of primitive societies, he describes them, they actually didn't believe there was a connection between coitus and procreation, because of the way that they ritualistically approached it through all these different sort of transcendent sort of angles, so that they just had no recollection that the material process is related to. They just believed it was some completely different thing. And I think you would have to be, you know, I think almost in a certain sense, those people are kind of blessed with an ability to be so unmaterialistic about it, regardless of whether or not that's scientifically wrong. I think we should be able to appreciate the fact that those people had such a veneration for certain rituals and certain processes and certain traditions that they weren't even considering whether or not these things had material repercussions. It was all, you know, on a higher level of experience.
Well, to get to the point of the dancing around here is that a belief in AI is really a belief in not only the spiritual but the metaphysical not really existing. It is predicated on a purely physiocratic view of the world, which I think is incompatible with like non-paused modes of thought, to put it in those terms. I think that it's the true danger of AI and people who dabble in the veneration of it is the logical conclusions of it. It's everything that builds up to it, and everything that builds out of it, that it displays a mode of thinking that is either naive and unknowing or purely physiocratic. You either don't understand the logical implications of what you're talking about, or you do and you're a complete kind of biological machine Reddit atheist. You put in the notes here that a lot of this does sound like the maneuvering into place as like technological fact, many of the planks of like atheist thinking, the atheist movement.
Yes.
If you mainstream the idea of thinking machines, you go a large way to, you know, outgrouping anyone who has any kind of not only religious but metaphysical thinking.
Yes. You do. And the other thing, I think it was you, Scrump Monkey, you said this was only possible in the light of a liberal society. I think a totalitarian socialist society could have this too. For example, the USSR or modern-day China, I think could, I'm not saying they will, but I think could generate, or could have, since the Soviet Union is past tense, generated such a hope and AI. So, for example, at the end of the Soviet era, they were hoping that automation would solve the problem of production for socialism.
Well, I think I probably misspoke. I probably meant to say like a managerial society, like a modern state. I honestly don't see totalitarian systems as materially different than our current system, as those who watch other streams would know. But I think that for us to be talking about it requires a system like we have. And liberal democracy is one of those all-encompassing systems. It's a total society, really.
Well, yeah,
and it really requires a physiocratically bent total state for you to believe in a non-traditional society, basically. If you have a non-quote-unquote modern group of people with a non-modern group of thinking, they really couldn't conceive of AI as a real possibility.
What I was going to say, you can look at the fact that I think in a certain sense, since I'm not really sure I could put a date on it, but say at least the 20s and the 30s, socialist economists, if I may use that term, have been trying to solve the problem of the economy by a single algorithm or by a combination of algorithms, which is ultimately them, grasping at straws and getting to the stuff that we collectively refer to, or sorry, colloquially refer to as AI nowadays. And it's sort of, I think it's as sort of Todd mentioned there, it's indicative of their sort of system of thinking that they would have, especially the sort of Bolsheviks. They were adamant that the liberation of the proletariat was going to come by the machine. I mean, that was the only other criticism of Lenin other than, ooh, he killed people. He's a state capitalist, this, that, and the next thing is, well, he didn't wait for liberalism to develop the technology required to free the proletariat.
And this is sort of what Spengler gets at when he says that the sort of materialist spirit of capitalism and the materialist spirit of socialism are two sides of the same coin. They both want to liberate the working man, but they differ on the ways to do it.
It's really the point that the AI in modern conception is the ultimate manager, is the ultimate managerialist. It is the manifestation of kind of the neutral, all-knowing institution. It's like the fever dream of the modern state in whichever form it takes. It's kind of tailor-made for it. Especially in the conception that we have, the bug man conception of it that we have here with the Google engineer. Again, we should be suspicious of claims of AI purely because it serves their agenda so perfectly. It is exactly what they are looking for in exactly the right terms, exactly the right place, and it fills exactly the function that they think a societal overlord should fill. Whether or not they believe it's making decisions, or they know that they are the ones make essentially creating the inputs and making decisions for it. And to kind of answer my own question earlier, I think there has to be this layer of people at the very, very top who know it's bullshit, who know that they will really be the ones in control of the machine. Because otherwise, I don't think that those people who are power-minded would develop it. I think if the people who held power genuinely believed in the possibility of AI, that they would go out and smash all the computers because they see it as a threat to them. Because they would
Machines,
see the
smash the
possibility.
machines.
Yeah, they would see the possibility of the malevolent AI and it would scare them. It would become an actual threat to them. So I do think that a lot of people at the very top of the power structure must know that this isn't possible.
I think Bill Joy hints at that. If you read that article, he sort of is like letting the mask slip, like, hey guys, it's not actually real. We're just gonna like control you with advanced algorithms. That seems to be the mask slipping a little bit. And yeah, as far as anybody believing any AI prognostications, the prognostications from Google and Facebook about AI are about as credible as Stalin's 5-year plan quote is from Pravda.
Yeah, just because you can get a supposedly authoritative source to say something doesn't make it real.
Don't
It's
look behind the
extremely
curtain,
basic.
citizen. There's
Yeah,
nothing to
it's
see.
ve it is very Wizard of Oz in that ultimately you as a pleb, as a citizen, will never know if this is a thinking machine or not. You don't have the capacity to do that. You'll never have the knowledge to do that. So you might as well assume that it is just a malevolent manifestation of the people in power. It's the safest route to take. Even if you do nominally believe in AI and your worldview is physiocratic, it is of benefit to you to reject it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the people in power don't ever give you any reason to assume good intentions.
Well, they never have.
That's why I'm always armed with the inverse of Hanlon's razor.
Yeah, can you prove it's not a conspiracy?
I think we've sort of rounded out everything notes wise that I wanted to mention. Before we forget to do it, I'm just going to thank all the people who turned up for the stream this evening, the members, people who give super chats and donate to Streamlabs and elsewhere for help keeping us this whole thing ticking over. I don't know, is there any sort of closing things people want to desperately mention?
The only thing I'll say is that AI is impossible because the mind and the brain are not identical.
Yes. In terms of, I don't know, I think we've covered most things very well, but I would just finish with a couple of things for people to look out for. And again, the big thing I want them to look out for is the conflation of these overarching algorithmic systems with life forms is going to be, I think, the major push in their acceptance in certain places. Especially as we move into the future, I'm talking 10, 20 years time when these systems get more and more complete and we resemble China more. In fact, it might be more difficult in somewhere like China because they are technically a slightly less advanced society, at least on the ground level than we are. They do have a bit more belief in kind of magic than we do. So they've probably been less primed than we have in terms of fiction. But I think people out there are very primed to believe in the primacy of the algorithm. And it's something that should be very virulently resisted.
Yeah, all I'm saying is you can't spell Antichrist without AI.
Ha
I hate the Antichrist. I hate the Antichrist.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Although.
Oh, there's one thing I forgot to. I posted it in the. I think I put it in the chat there. But there's a very. You mentioned Metamorphosis by Kafka, and there's always a funny tweet by Richard Dawkins to dump on the
Give
atheists, in
me
which he does
second.
not.
Let me
I've got
open
it.
that up
I've
and
put
put it
that in
on
the chat there.
screen.
Yeah, because there's I can't find it right now. But there's just the image of the bug with a fedora on it. I responded. It's gone now from my old account. But the illustration of the bug. It's just it's irony in many senses because it's the bug man not understanding the bug man. which is many layers of it, yeah. Richard Dawkins from 5th of June 2021. Kafka's Metamorphosis is called a major work of literature. Why? If it's science fiction, it's bad science fiction. If, like Animal Farm, it's allegory, then an allegory for what? Scholarly answers range from pretentious Freudian to far-fetched feminist. I don't get it. Where are the emperor's clothes?
That
I
he
just.
gets turned into a bug, and his first concern is whether or not he has to call into sick work that day. That's the
It's
fucking point.
the thing with Metamorphosis is that it's so like it's Kafka going, it's one of his more obvious works. He's a, see, he's a, he's literally we turned him into a bug, and he's worried about going to work. If anything, it's almost hackneyed. Sorry, I just wanted to. I always think that's very funny, and it's a great illustration of like the far end of the bug man mindset we get here, and they can't conceive of something as really relatively simple as Kafka's Metamorphosis and what it
I think
represents.
what that proves is that Richard Dawkins is actually not human since he doesn't understand irony and is
Yes.
actually a complex, simple AI algorithm. Yeah,
Yes, he
that
probably
again.
is. That would be the ultimate irony. I've also dropped Radlib's stream in the chat. He'll be starting just about now. I think he's got Pama hat on as well, so remind the Radlib who sent you.
Yes, we will do a quick raid there. Again, thank you guys for coming. We'll try and have some links if you're watching this as a recording in the description for the video that we linked, and I'll put a copy of the Mises Human Action in there with a couple of page references so people can see where we were reading from. But apart from that, I think I've dunked on the atheists sufficiently this evening. So I will just say goodbye from me.
And goodbye for me. And thank you very much, Todd, for joining us this evening.
Thank
Yes,
you very
thank
much
you.
for having me on.
See you guys. Oh, there we go. I think we're off air now.